Blog Talk Radio.
This is Booger T. Washington Speaks, hosted by the great-grandson of Booger T. Washington. And tonight, we are welcoming all of you for what we hope will be a very lively discussion, because what we hope to speak about tonight, what we intend to speak about tonight, is how the HBCUs can be fixed, how the historically black colleges and universities, most of which are in deep financial trouble, some of which are on the verge of losing their regional accreditation. And we want to discuss how these schools that were founded for the elevation of the black people here in America after slavery, how they can be fixed. But before we continue, we would like to begin with a prayer. And as you enjoyed a few bars of the song, This Love of Mine, we want to refer to the true love we should have in our heart for our God and Creator. And therefore, we will read from the book known as the Quran, or Holy Quran, from the beginning, the opening chapter, and I'll read the English interpretation, which says, I seek refuge in Almighty God from the wicked, rejected Satan. In the name of God, whose name in Arabic is Allah, in the name of Allah, most gracious, most merciful, praise be to Allah, the cherisher and the sustainer of the worlds, most gracious, most merciful, master of the day of judgment. You alone do we worship, and your help we seek. Show us the straight way, the way of those on whom you have bestowed your grace, those whose portion is not wrath, meaning your anger, or those who go astray. So we're going to go ahead, and as we wait for our panel to come online, we want to just share something that really reminds us of days in the past when we had a very strong movement during the 1960s for the elevation of our people. Community groups were being formed, people from different educational backgrounds and different economic backgrounds were coming together to try to do things that would improve the life of African Americans. And one of the main people that was responsible for this happening was an African American who came from a small town not far from where I live. I'm in the Augusta, Georgia area. And this young man, who was only in his early 30s at the time, came from a small town about 50, 60 miles away from here called Sandersville, Georgia, was only able to complete 3 years of elementary school in a poor rural school, but he was very, very well self-educated, and he started a movement to help our African-American people change our condition. And I want to read something that this man, whose name at the time that he lived in Sandersville, Georgia, was Elijah Robert Poole, but as time went by, he became known as Elijah Muhammad. And he says in a book that he published during the 1960s entitled Message to the Black Man in America, he says, "Help self, what must be done with the Negroes? Since our being brought in chains to the shores of America, our brain power, labor, skills, and wealth have been taken, given, and spent toward building and adding to the civilization of another people. It is time for you and me, the so-called Negroes, to start doing something for ourselves. We must not let our children be as we, beggars of another man for his home, his facilities, for clothing, food, and the means of providing a living. Man depends on land for the necessities, food, clothing, and shelter for survival. A prime requisite for freedom and independence is having one's own land. There can be no freedom without a people having their own land. The acquisition of land has been the factor for more wars than any other cause. Economists agree that in order for any type of nation or system, capitalism or communism, democracy or totalitarian or what have you, to exist and have a degree of independence, there must be ownership of land. The so-called Negroes are without a state that they can call their own. We have nothing to show for our more than 310 years of forced labor and more than 100 years, and now 150 years, of our free servitude to our slave master's children. We were brought here to work. We have worked. We are still the workers. Some of us say, what will we do if we do not work for the white man? How will we live? I say, when you are free and independent, you have a job. You have a tremendous task of doing something for yourself. You have the job of building a civilization for yourself as other free and independent people are doing for themselves. As a people, we must become producers and not remain consumers and employees. We must be able to extract raw materials from the earth and manufacture them into something useful for ourselves. This would create jobs in production. We must remember that without land, there is no production. The surplus of what we produce, we would sell. This would develop a field of commerce and trade as other free and independent people whose population is less than that of the 20 million, and of course now it's over 40 million, so-called Negroes who are independent, who are dependent in America. We must begin at the cradle and teach our babies that they must do something for self. They must not be like we, their fathers and mothers, who look to the slave masters or slave makers and slave masters' children for everything. We must teach our children now with an enthusiasm exceeding that which our slave masters used in having our forefathers and mothers embed the seed of dependency within us. We must stop the process of giving our brain power, labor, and wealth to our slave master's children. We must eliminate the master-slave relationship. We must educate ourselves and our children into the rich power of knowledge, which has elevated every people who have sought and used it. We must give the benefit of our knowledge to the elevation of our own people. Presently, in this country, in almost all of the major universities and colleges, there are thousands of young students from Africa and Asia. Yet, as young, primitive, and backward as we say these countries of Africa and Asia might be, their students here are returning to their shores. Their intent and purpose is to give their people the benefit of their learning. All civilized people give the benefit of their knowledge, skill, and wealth to their own people. Those who do not are called traitors, defectors, spies, tools, and Uncle Toms. Why should we spend 12 and 16 years seeking an education only to give the benefit of our knowledge back to the one we sought it from? It is time for us to wake up. Why should we work to give the meager earnings of our labor back to our slave master's children? Why can't we have our own? Why can't we do for our own? Why can't we learn to spend with and support our own? Why can't we strive toward keeping our brain power, labor, and wealth within and among and elevating our own? And we'll stop the reading right there. I see we do have a caller on the line. And our topic, as you may have heard in the beginning, is what can we do to fix the African-American CUs. Would you like to go ahead? You have the mic, caller. Would you like to comment on that?
Are you talking to me?
Yes, yes, you're on the line.
Well,
you got the mic.
I didn't know what caller. You know something? Certainly, you know I can comment on that. But I think what I need to do is listen to other callers, because I have no idea what others think. I kind of moved away and got out of the way because I'm very active in civil rights, you know, very early on in my youth. In fact, I knew John Lewis. I didn't know him, but he was always at all the meetings and conventions and some workshops that I was in. I was right there. And I looked at John and I said, well, we are getting older. And I'm thinking, you know, it's been so long. I just don't know what people are thinking. And I want to hear them, because what you just read is perfect. It makes all the sense in the world. It says everything that needs to be said. And I guess, you know, at the Trump inauguration, the people were saying, and he said, all that talk, and they weren't doing anything. And they've been very resentful of our black men who could really speak, which was King, Martin Luther King, and Obama. So they keep slapping at it. I listen to those right-wing shows because I didn't know how they think. And I've been listening for 3 or 4 years now, and I'm learning. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad even said that they were very jealous and envious of the black man. And that just about seems to be what the problem is. No matter what Obama did, said, or whatever, they had a horrible commentary about it, tore it down. And so I said that to say, these younger people, what do they think? And how are they thinking? Because we can do all the talking. We had the best writers. And even what your great-grandfather wrote was sufficient. And Carter G. Woodson. And as you have said, Frederick Douglass and David Walker. I mean, they were very prolific. And where are these other people? I'm sure some of them read some of that. So what are they thinking? I just need to know, because my talk, my commentary, or whatever, what is it going to do? I think when I learn what they think or how they are thinking, and maybe they are not thinking. Now I'll go ahead and say, I got an email from a young man that I call my godson, 28 years old. He said he was upset because Martin Luther King brother, a son, the third, a fourth, I don't know, went to see Trump, and he was blasting him in this email and quoting Malcolm. Now, he's not a Muslim. I think he's a little small-time Sunday school teacher. He has a master's degree, very educated. His mother and father both are educated, miseducated, the way Carter G. Woodson said it. But I didn't even respond because I don't think that, I mean, they've been using our black men. And he was saying they pick the kind of blacks they want. Yes. But what is he saying? Did he hear somebody? He said that Malcolm said that. So they are reading Malcolm. And do they just get together in their little groups and talk it? Maybe that's a step up. I don't know. So I don't know what to comment on, Brother Imam, because I don't know what people think. And it does look like they love the devil because he gives you nothing, meaning we probably don't know how bad them putting themselves in the image of Jesus as a Caucasian people, maybe that really have destroyed our people's minds and they just can't come up out of it because I really don't know what they think and I prefer shut up. You see, because I want to hear what they say and what they think.
Well, good. Actually, so far tonight, you're the only caller that's called in. I was expecting several other people, and they still may come on board before the hour is up. And, of course, at that time, we'll definitely encourage them. We'll repeat, you know, what the question is, and we'll encourage them to give their points of view. But in the meantime, I do want to share, because there may be others that are actually listening via Internet, and they don't show up on my dashboard, so I don't know if anybody else is actually listening, but not where they can actually talk, because I did advertise that people could go up on the Internet and listen if that's all they wanted to do, and I have no way of knowing how many people may be listening. This actually went out on Facebook, so it may be broadcast, you know, to people all over the world. I have Facebook friends all over the world, so I don't know who may be listening, but for those who are listening, who do not show up where I can actually ask you to speak, I do want to share something that is very pertinent to this conversation, and this is from a work, a book by the scholar and religious leader and the guide for many, many people for 40 years, approximately 33 years, actually. But he had history as a guide for black people before he became the leader of the Nation of Islam. And he was a minister for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad in Philadelphia for several years. So it's correct to say 40 years he was a leader of black people. This is Imam Wallace D. Muhammad in the book that he wrote entitled An African American Genesis that was published in 1986. And the chapter that he titled The Struggle Against Oppression. He says, I would like to begin this section by expressing the words of God in the Holy Quran, which says, quote, O you who believe, shall I lead you to a bargain that will save you from a grievous penalty, that you believe in God and his messenger, and that you strive your utmost in the path of God with your property and your very souls. That will be best for you if you but knew, unquote. And Imam Muhammad continues by saying, this is not just speaking of any striving or struggle, but a striving and a struggle that respects our Creator, the maker of the things that we are using to advance the struggle in the path of God. The things we use are our wealth and our very souls. The part of the verse that reads, your very souls, refers to ourselves and our personal life. We are to put our energy, our personal concerns, our heart, our sympathies, our intellect, our muscles, and all that we have in the path of God. We do not struggle for something imagined, a fantasy, for something unreal. The struggle is for the real things that God has directed us to on this earth and in this human environment. God says to those who oppress man's moral, intellectual, social, and political potential, quote, "Certainly the suppression of man's potential is worse than slaughter," unquote. The suppression of the God-given potential in man is a worse crime than outright slaughter. An effort or campaign for crushing the will and spirit of the common people is a bigger issue, a bigger crime than the outright killing for wealth or territory. Men kill for wealth and territory for the purpose of expanding the domain of their nation or power. Yet this is not as great a crime as the suppression or denying the potential that God put in man for his or her dignity, his or her freedom, and for his or her function as a total creature on this earth. He says, "We are happy to see better days in America and the world." And of course, this was written 30 years ago, and hopefully this situation won't be changing in the near future. There's some quotes about that, but I'll continue with the quotation. He says, "Yet we are not going to be so foolish or naive as to overlook the subtle oppression and serious evils that still work to undermine the freedom of the common person. For example, it is not entirely the fault of the African-American community that we are spending our wealth on quick self-destructive pleasures, such as drugs, a shallow image, silly fads, silly hairdos, silly dress styles, and other destructive things. Many of our youngsters," and of course this was back in 1986, "are now wearing the popular dunce cap. And they don't even know that the name of it is a dunce cap." And I think what he was referring to was when our young folks back in the 80s were wearing the caps with the bill turned around on the side of their head. And in the olden days, in the days when Imam Muhammad was going to school, apparently that was called a dunce cap, to wear your hat like that. But he says, "It is not our fault entirely that we are using our resources on these temporary and passing things." And I'll stop right there. So I see another caller has come on the line from the 251 area code. And so I just want to reintroduce the topic. The topic that we began this discussion with was, what can be done to fix the historically black colleges and universities? Obviously, many of them need some kind of fix because many of them are on the verge of financial collapse. Several of them recently have been on probation with the accrediting bodies. My alma mater, Tuskegee University, is currently on sanction. They're on their second year of warning. Payne College here in Augusta, Georgia, has actually had their accreditation revoked by the Regional Accrediting Association, but it's on stay right now. The federal judge in the area has said that they have a stay while they're trying to work out an appeal to be able to remain accredited. But technically, they have had their accreditation revoked. And this is a more increasing trend year by year. There are lots of reasons why the schools are in trouble. So the question that we have out right now is, what can be done to fix the historically black colleges and universities? And then a caller from 870, after we hear from the caller from 251, then you can repeat what you had actually said, you know, about what I consider to be the apathy of many of our African-American people towards the dire situation that we are in. A caller from 251, would you like to comment on what you heard me read or what I just said? Just a minute, caller from 251, and I'll put you on the mic. Okay,
yes,
251. Fine,
yes.
How are you?
I'm doing just great. You know, I am one of Booker T. Washington's biggest fans, and I will always believe that what happened to Booker T. Washington, his untimely death in 1915, all we're looking at is a domino effect of what was planned to happen, because he was the head. And I always believe if you cut off the head, and the body is going to die. And I just feel that Booker T. Washington had the greatest plan for us in as far as education and economics. And when he was taken off the face of this earth, this is the result of what we got. And I will always believe that it was planned that way for us to fail because people recognized what this man was doing and could do, and they wanted to stop that progress, and they did. And all we're looking at now is the domino effect of what they did back in 1915.
Well, I certainly agree with you. And before I ask our caller from 870 to comment, because I definitely want to have you expand on that question so our caller that just came online can hear it and hopefully respond, but I don't want to go forward until I share something with you. One of the most eminent journalists and historians of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. I haven't heard of any new publications about him lately. I believe he's still living, but he was the editor-in-chief for Jet Magazine and Ebony Magazine, the journalistic section for many years, and that's Mr. Lerone Bennett. And in 1964, he said that there is no hope for African-Americans to develop an ethos of power. And that's one of the things that obviously our people lack in many areas, which will relieve our people of the psychic burden of racial inferiority, which is one of the things that, if you've read the Willie Lynch letter, was one of the keynotes of his program to enslave our people mentally, was to put a psychic burden of racial inferiority on our people. But unless we stop accepting uncritically and completely the values and goals of the racial group that have been our oppressors, unquote. And I add in my book, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, that this distinguished historian and social commentator asserts that the consequence of accepting the success and power ethic of the empowered white people is the hatred of our black selves. When there is no, or where there is no defense against the pathological psychic humiliation of knowing that our slave masters, forefathers, and their descendants even had deprived us of the knowledge of self, the knowledge of God, the knowledge of the devil, and it also put us in mind that we were not even fully human. And I do want to add this, and then I'll go ahead and turn this over. Booker T. Washington said that African Americans cannot compete with white people until we have laid the same economic foundation that they have laid. We cannot imitate them in their play and amusement while they own the industries to which we go with our hats in our hand, seeking opportunities to work or get sports contracts or get our music produced and distributed. And I'll end by giving an illustration of what he's talking about with a 21st century example. An African-American singing group, and there are very many that are doing this, and band has a contract to perform a concert on a weekend in Los Angeles. Their pay for this contract, for this engagement, is $100,000. The concert is on a Saturday night. This group charters an airplane for $30,000, and these are actual real figures that I have researched, $30,000 round trip, so that they can arrive on Wednesday morning, giving them time to go shopping. And, of course, they are accompanied by their women who want to shop, and then also to party for three nights, practicing only on Saturday afternoon before the concert. So rather than spend 3 days each way on the road by chartering a bus for $5,000 round trip, this is a 40-passenger bus, the African-American group literally wastes $25,000 of their earnings by taking the more expensive option because that's what the successful white entertainers are doing. Rather than use that $25,000 that they could have saved to invest in their own music studio, which will enable them to retain more of their recording royalties. They will throw away that money for fun in Los Angeles, and that is because they are emulating white people who can afford to do it. Some can. And the white entertainers, though, are part of an ethnic community that is in control of the recording business. So they don't have to worry about coming up with 50% down to get a loan to put a studio together, because they know people in their own ethnic community that will trust them and give them a loan with maybe no down payment. But our people can't get that, and yes, they waste the money that they could have used to get the down payment just to go out there and party. So something has happened to our people's mindset. And this is one of the things that the HBCUs, unfortunately, have not been able to fix. So the mic is open. So anyone, caller from 870, would you like to go back to the comments that you had made earlier so that our new caller can hear that and respond?
Well, she doesn't need to hear that. She said it perfectly. I like that definition. It was a domino effect and still going on. That was a perfect explanation for what's happening. She said the right thing. Perfect. She said the Honorable Booker T. Washington laid out the best plan, and she was right. And that plan was working, actually. And she was right when she said they looked and saw that this was going to be successful. And I'm sure that they rounded up all of the enemies that they could and started to pick and pick and pick and tear down what he was about. I had never heard, I had read the book Up From Slavery, back in '70s, I think, early '70s. But when I wrote that paper on him, because that was what my professor assigned to me to make a comparison and contrast between Booker T. and W.E. Du Bois, is when I began to hear from other, and I was an older woman at the time when I went back for that master's, and I began to talk with some of the faculty who was my age, and they had heard of Booker T, and the rumors were he was getting too big, getting too powerful, and was going to take over a lot of black people's businesses, and they didn't trust him. He had come to this school in my hometown and wanted to make a branch out of this college and have it to be one of Tuskegee's branches. So Booker T. Washington was thinking, and many blacks who want to be the chief of their tribes, they don't want to give up their little portion of what they thought was their power hold. And I think this, whoever she is, laid it out perfectly. From that time on, it was a domino effect. Whomever we would respect and admire and put and give them our respect and our time and money, they would tear them down. And mostly our own people that they use to do that. So it's kind of sad that we just, I don't know if it was because they brought over different tribes, and our different tribes had an envy for the other tribes. They mixed us up and sent us to different plantations and made them lose respect for family. Family means familiar, and they didn't get a chance to learn to stay with what was familiar with them. Now, they did a job. They really did a job, and I think the domino effect is the best explanation I've heard in a long time. Because she was absolutely right. Booker T, the education was going to give us the economics, and especially the way he designed it. And she said it. He had the best plan. And even they tried it again with using the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Now, Imam Wardi Muhammad made a comment one day and said, when they set up these civil rights programs, especially SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coalition, they were using them to pick off certain leaders, and they were going to use, and did use, those leaders for their program. and their programming. I've told many people that they certainly were trying to use me. They got John Lewis, and that was fine. You know, we needed some of that, but it slowed down our progress, I think. And when Imam said that, I could see that most of the people who did come, they picked them off and used them for their programming. And Julian Bond and Jesse Jackson, and they set them up in different organizations and programs and for themselves and their programming. Everything that took us away from ourselves, I think they put people in behind Dr. Booker T. Washington that didn't know what they were doing. They were like the guy in Amos and Andy, you know, I is the kingfish. And that's what they began to do, put kingfish everywhere that didn't see the same vision, didn't have the vision, and didn't care about the vision not being met. Because only a few people in every tribe or every community that can really see. And they don't want those that can see. And I think that's what they did. They started looking for him, like they said in Scripture. Herod was looking for Jesus. And I think they're still doing that. They look for certain people who would have that ability and destroy them if they can't use them for their program. And as a people, we just need to take a look at that and do something about it. But we're so greedy. You know, nobody wants to suffer and sacrifice. And you do end up with nothing. You know, they stripped me. And we've seen them strip all of the people that didn't come along and do what they... After they used W.E. Du Bois, he fled to Africa, to Egypt. He was living in Egypt before he went to Accra. And he ended up converting to Islam. Now, they didn't publicize that, but I told you, I sat with his wife. And she wanted the Muslims to take his papers because he had learned how he got tricked. And she said he confessed before he died that Booker T. Washington had the best plan and was right. But in his youth, they used him to make Booker T. Washington look like, oh, that's not, we need to be intellectual. We don't need to be, you know, digging into the earth. And but his wife, Shirley Du Bois, that we had dinner with, said, sitting next to me, said that he confessed that Booker T. Washington had the right plan and wanted the Muslims to take his papers. She didn't want Harvard to have his papers, but I think Harvard ended up with them because we had nothing at the time. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad had died, and we had no structure. And we both, Dr. Ali and I both decided that it wouldn't be best to leave the papers with the Muslims, not right now. I don't know who got them. I hope Sonia Sanchez talked her to leave them with Cornell. But I think the last I heard, Harvard did get his papers because that's, you know, he had graduated from Harvard. But she said something. She said it. That summed it up perfectly.
Well, thank you. And I want to ask our call from air code 251, if you prefer to remain anonymous, that's fine. The program is being broadcast, you know, on the internet all over the world, and you may or may not want to identify yourself. But if you would like to introduce yourself, then please go ahead.
Okay, my name is Paulette Davis Horton, and I am a registered nurse. And through my research and the fact that I live where Booker T. Washington spent his last vacation, the pastors here told me that Booker T. Washington was assassinated, and being a professional nurse, I looked into his death, and I published a book, Death in 60 Days, because I realized that Booker T. Washington did not die a normal death. But if you look through the World Book Encyclopedia, you can look through anything and look through anybody's research prior to 2006, and you cannot find where this man was sick or he missed speaking engagements or anything. Booker T. Washington was alive and well until he went to the North in 1915, and they destroyed this man because he was on the right track of helping to elevate African Americans. And what we are experiencing today is the effects of what they wanted to do. It's been 100 years, and they planned it that way. So as far as these colleges, because you don't know where it was broken, it's hard to fix it. If you go back and look at what Booker T. Washington was trying to do, it would bring some enlightenment to you that this man was murdered because of what he was trying to do. Go back and read what he was trying to do, and you will be educated, and you can go from there, because having all these meetings at these colleges, you can meet all day long. But if our young people cannot read and write and learn how to have character in themselves, like Booker T. Washington said, we will fail. And it was planned that way by killing Booker T. Washington. He was the head, and and what we're looking at is what they tried to do, and it worked.
Yep, I agree. They haven't healed from that yet. In fact, they instituted many more plans to make sure no one else would ever rise. A few people who heard him and some of the students, they were able to execute some of what he said. I remember the man on our campus was a brick mason, and he had gotten that from Tuskegee. He and his wife both had gone to Tuskegee, and he was one of the best brick masons around here and taught, and they ended up having a department of brick masonry here, and he taught brick masonry, and those few, there are none doing it now, but those who did come up under that man, Mr. Mazik, they were the best bricklayers around here. Now, they're old. They're 70 and 80 years old now. I don't know if they passed it on. I used to ask them, are you passing that on? And, they're sons, but their sons are ruined. And I think the plans were those television shows, Welcome Back, Carter, and that thing that little Robin gal used to be in, and all those shows that had them acting smart, talking back, acting crazy in class, set the example for them to tear up the schools. Plus, they hired teachers who could barely read themselves, and I saw that when I came back to Arkansas and began to sub, and I was looking at the lesson plans, and one man couldn't even spell his own subject. His wife had gotten him the job. So they were just putting in people, friends, and some of their lovers and mistresses and people who couldn't teach, and they integrated to get up on us to pick out the scholars. That Rhodes Scholar guy that came up dead here in Arkansas, they integrated so they could spot the genius type children and stray them away from, or come up with a wreck that he came up with, a superficial wreck. So they're still plotting and planning, and we can't see. We can't see because we were made to love that didn't look out for us, and it's done so subtle. I never will forget Bill Clinton on Arsenio Hall's show one night, and they were talking about something. He went on playing cool, put his shades on, and blew his horn. I already knew little things about Bill because I was here in Arkansas, and there was rumors out already that he liked, black women. But he told Arsenio, they were talking about something, and Arsenio, he almost spilled it. He said, there were the big riots and gangs was going heavily at that time in Los Angeles. And our city asked him or told him something. And Bill Clinton said, well, y'all, you know, the black people don't, the structure is torn. And he had to shut up because he realized he was talking to a predominantly black audience and blacks tuned in to Arsenio. He almost told that our whole structure had been torn and slain, really. He had to shut up. And I started to write or call Arsenio and bring that out. And maybe he caught it. I don't know. But I knew somebody who knew Arsenio personally. But they planned that thing, and it was structured to destroy us. And they destroyed our children. When I went back to the public schools and began to sub, I was shocked at the mentalities. Not just the students, but the teachers, the principals. So it was done on purpose. And we were warned that they were going to do it. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad said it. Imam said it. And they start offering them things like this rap music chance and getting in the movies. And I noticed the other day there was an article on people that died that we didn't know was dead. And I was shocked at some of the black men who have died. I knew I hadn't been seeing them. So they're assassinating our own people. In fact, I just had an experiment in the hospital, almost died. So they know what they're doing. We just have to, if we don't start loving ourselves again, respecting ourselves again, and trying to unite again like we used to do, there's no hope. But they've split us up, got us wanting to be anything other than the proper man and woman that's going to be successful enough to build up our characters and build us up. They put everything that's filthy in front of us today. And that's where our people's minds are. The preachers, teachers. I was shocked at the way the teachers dress and go to school today. I mean, they just really tore us down. We were warned, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and Imam warned us too, that was what was going to happen. But she got it right there when she said that Booker T plan was the best plan, and it really was, because the others were making speeches, but Booker T Washington was doing something, and they had to destroy him.
I just want to make a comment, Paulette. Yesterday or the day before, I was reading Booker T. Washington's biography, autobiography, the story of my life and work. And it says in that book, this was part was written after he had died, that his wife, Mrs. Margaret Washington, when asked how Booker T. Washington was doing after he had his 3-week vacation down, I think it was 3 weeks, down in Coden, and they listed a number of people, including Dr. Kenny, his personal doctor, as well as some other people on the trustees and his personal staff, that there was a group of about 6-7 people that knew him very well that went down to his vacation in Coden, and all of them agreed that he looked very fit, that he had had a wonderful time. He had no health problems. And I've seen a picture of him fishing, and he certainly looked very healthy at that time where he was fishing on a rowboat down in Coden. And so when someone asked his wife about, him going up to New Haven, Connecticut, and also New York for a meeting in New Haven and a speech in New York, she said, he's fine. You know, there's nothing that would prevent him from being able to endure that arduous trip. And this was, he was supposed to get up there around the 25th of New York. You know all these facts. I don't have to tell you. We've talked about this. But the fact is that between the 25th of October and sometime before he died, or before he left New York to come back to Tuskegee, right before he died, we know that something happened to him, and we've already talked about that, and you've written about it in your book. But the point is that the people, and this is what concerns me, the people that were with him that knew he was in very fit condition did not make any kind of rancor that I know of about him going down so fast, because anyone would have known something had to happen to make him go down so fast. But it seems almost like that these people were bought off so they wouldn't make a big fuss about it. And what do you think about that?
Well, when the pastor...
They were afraid. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead.
They were afraid. You know that they had them beaten down really bad back then, and they didn't talk. You know, there were many blacks who didn't teach their children about the past. Our parents were afraid we would be running our mouths, and they didn't talk about it. You know, right now, when I kept trying to get black history in the classrooms, the teachers and parents were all afraid. Now, they're having black history taught in the churches that I suggested 40 years ago. I said, well, you at least own your churches. Go on Saturday and teach, and they're doing it now. Most of them don't know that was my idea because they're afraid to say, oh, it was a Muslim who did it. That's so insane. But they were afraid. They knew what happened to him, but they were afraid to talk or even act like they knew, because they knew that they knew them better than, you know, we know them today. That's why I was wondering why they were so anxious to get with them, because they knew them and they didn't trust them. And you hear when the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was calling them the devil, you hear people, they wouldn't join, but they would say, we don't need Elijah to tell us that. We know that. So I said all that to say that they knew that that character was evil. I think they were just frightened and afraid to talk. I'm sorry that I interrupted her, because I'm sure she's really thought about it.
Well, she's done a lot of research, too. Go ahead, Paulette.
Yes.
Okay. When the I did not know that he was assassinated until I was writing my book, Treasured Memories, and the past, and it's about the Baptist churches, and one of the pastors, his mentor was attended Tuskegee, and he told me there's a lot of dirty history from here to there, and he's the one said, take for example what they did to Booker T. Washington, and he said it as though I knew, which I did not know. And
right.
When he told me, yeah, you're right, they were afraid. And I asked the pastor, and he was going on 80 years old, and I asked him, when he told me that Booker T. Washington was assassinated, I said, well, why didn't anybody say anything? And he said, well, who were you going to tell? He said, if you had said anything about it,
your life
would be worth a nickel. But the reason I felt justified when the University of Maryland revisited his death in 2006, and they said he just died of high blood pressure because he didn't, you know, maybe didn't take care of himself and didn't eat right. But see, Booker T. Washington was a health fanatic. He exercised. They said it's after his vacation, and I asked them, I said, did y'all know that he had just gotten off vacation? And if you go to New York, the New York Tribune said Booker T. Washington is in no shape to go back to Tuskegee. He's had a nervous break. Now, this is after vacation. He had a nervous breakdown. He's extremely nervous, and he's aging rapidly. And they said he was collapsing. Those are not symptoms of high blood pressure, and anybody with high blood pressure can tell you that.
They planned. That was the reason they probably invited him to New York. You know,
right?
Because
they had to get it done. And
yeah.
I was sad to say that in my hometown, right after his death, the person he was on vacation with put a letter in the New York Times, and I flew to New York to look at it. He wrote a letter saying Emmett Scott will be his successor. how could you say that and a man died the day before?
Wow.
How can you know that the trains will be leaving Mobile going to Montgomery? How could you? We don't even arrange death today that fast.
Yeah, oh, yeah. They do plan. They plot and plan.
Oh, they planned it. They planned it. I told them they planned it. And it's just that because we were not able to talk about it, they got away with it. But I felt justified because it was the doctors that revisited his death, and because I am a professional nurse just like they are, I felt justified in presenting my findings. And I disagree.
You did a wonderful job because I was told about your book. I never bought it because I'm not in position. I used to buy so many books, and really I don't even have my books. It's in storage, and I wonder if they're there. But when I heard about your work, I was so happy. And I knew, I said, well, God guided that person to do that because somebody needed to do it. But they were all too afraid to do it earlier. And they are that way today, even worse, especially in this hometown. I mean, these people, I had one doctor that said, oh, no, you don't need a pacemaker. And the next 2 weeks he was saying, oh, yeah, you do, you go. So I've learned that they don't let you out of med school, law school, and other things unless you make a deal. And the reason you have such bad health care stuff going on, that was one man, Caucasian man, wrote a book about how bad the health care was, and he wrote that book back in 1970. And it dawned on me that these people make deals. I've learned that in my local town, hometown here, you only get a job if your husband is one of the snitches, one of the agents. So it's all hooked up. And they use masonry and Eastern Star stuff to do that. So they got it all hooked up. But it's all kind of falling apart, too. That's why I understood that the Caucasians wanted Trump in. Trump is not supposed to be part of the cabal, or that they're calling their cabal now, which would be the New World Order people and the globalists. I don't know that he isn't. But because I don't know how he could keep borrowing money if he was not connected somehow. But that was why the Tea Party came about, because they had learned that they had been tricked. In fact, they used the word bamboozle. See, the Caucasians thought they had had some privileges, and that they used some of them, made them think they were superior, and set them up, just like they set up the Ku Klux Klan. And then they've learned now, and they're angry. I think it was the Honorable Elijah Muhammad woke them up. They'll never admit it. But they began to realize that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was giving us the antidote we needed. And they were able to pull out who Elijah Muhammad was really talking about before we did. Because, see, we were just thinking it was the white man. But, see, they knew before we did it was the other people that ruled and controlled the white people. And that's what made the Tea Party and the left. And I ain't mad at the white people, because what they've done is they finally realized that they were being duped. And they finally have realized that's why they announced, even the Ku Klux Klan people are saying, well, we believe the blacks should have their own. You see, because they now realize they got set up. If you listen to David Duke, and I do, he's now realizing that the white man was being used by another people to keep us down, but keeping us down kept them down. Yes.
Excuse me, I have to break in because we've only got 60 seconds left.
Okay.
And for those people that are
not
in this panel, I want to say thank you all for tuning in who are listening. Thank you all for being on our panel tonight. We certainly want to continue this dialogue, and we hope that you'll join us again on next Saturday evening for a continuation of this wonderful talk that we have tonight. We ask you to be safe as you go about your business during the week. You know, the tempers of people are kind of high. We've seen about these riots throughout the country, or protests anyway. So we ask you just to keep a sane head. We're saying this to everyone, not just to you on the panel, but we ask that God will bless you. Thank you very much for joining us tonight, and good night. We're going to close now.
Good night.